Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware, in case any of you are not, of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. In my broadcast, some of you have noticed that you hear very little about financial support, and that's deliberate. We really trust God here on that score and firmly believe that God pays for what He orders. The same policy is true in my local church ministry. Other than the teaching we offer on these broadcasts, over the years I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. But on this program, I don't say a lot about those resources, much as I don't say a lot about finances, and I guess that omission in terms of resources kind of defeats the purpose. So grab a pen and paper and get prepared to write down a website. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. In fact, that book, The Finality of Jesus Christ, is not a long book, but it's a very important book, and if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage. Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mention those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We've come to 2 Samuel chapter 15, the narrative that describes the effort of Absalom to overthrow his father David. We were beginning to make an application about this treasonous uprising of Absalom against his father David. David was beginning to show his age. He seems vulnerable since this thing with Bathsheba. We pointed out he seemed less confident and, morally speaking, seems a little more paralyzed and confused because his sin had him morally compromised. He doesn't seem to have his eye on the ball quite as much as formerly, and I'm not the first to note those things. As a result, there were probably some lapses we mentioned at the end of our last study. Lapses in due diligence in the administration of justice. we can read that between the lines in this narrative in chapter 15. Some trickle-down lapses of zeal in taking care of business that created some pockets of unrest in his kingdom and among his officials. And if we're right about all of this, and we probably are, I think, it explains how Absalom could so easily, over time, succeeding in alienating the affections of the nations to the degree that he was able to make such a strong play for the throne. But I said there is a very dangerous thing, by way of application, and one sees it a lot in church life. And this is a good point to talk about it before we move on past verse 1 in the narrative. For what happened then is instructive about what still happens sometimes in our body life and has such ugly outcomes. God had put David on the throne of Israel. It was God's place to remove David when that time came. Now, there would have been a lot of ways that that might have happened, all legitimate. The Lord might do that directly through death or disability, or the Lord might have persuaded David, the Spirit of God, to say, look, I think my time has come and gone. It could have been by a consensus of the elders of the nation, who might have been moved by the Spirit of God to persuade David, or any other king for that matter, that it was time to step down. The point is that God can bring about these changes directly, or he can do it indirectly. But folks, it is never God's approved way for an unofficial cabal of conspirators to work the angles to displace a man whom God has appointed. But in this youth-loving culture, it is not uncommon for just such a thing to happen. People can get tired of the same old face and the same old voice. We live in a culture, if anything is older than 5 minutes, it's history and it's irrelevant. And so people can begin to agitate openly or behind the scenes for change. People today don't ask, don't particularly care what God's will is in the matter. They just assume that God would favor whatever they want. And maybe they are concerned about church growth or whatever, and they just think the church would be better off with a different leader or a younger leader than the one they have. Now, let it be said that like aging athletes, some of us pastors don't know when our skills have faded intolerably, and some pastors just hang on and the church suffers. They don't recognize that they're not on their game any longer. But there's never any place in the church for an Absalom. There's never any place for Absalom or his associates who want to put asunder what God has put together. As I remember when I was just a little boy, perhaps 5 years old, standing with my father outside our church way back in Fayetteville, West Virginia. And our old pastor, Dr. James F. Frame, was well past his prime, and that was pretty obvious even to me as a 5-year old. And some of the deacons in our Baptist church were out whispering, kind of wanting to shove him aside. I'll never forget my dad telling him, you leave that to God. Wait on God's time. It will come soon enough. My father was saying that God is sovereign. More will be lost by forcing the issue than allowing the Lord to work out his timing. David was a wounded warrior by this time. He had failed in certain ways, and there were consequences of his failure. And there may have been lapses, as I mentioned, owing to the aging process. We'll talk about that possibility a little later on. But the truth is, as we learn from the subsequent narratives, God's hands were still on this man. He was still the object of God's favor. He was still a man after God's own heart for all of his human foibles. And God's power was, as this narrative is going to show clearly, on David's side, not Absalom's. Folks, hear me. Never, never, never get caught up in some little church conspiracy of that kind as part of somebody's misbegotten plan to save the church. Listen to me. If your church is worth saving, God will do it without your godless interference. Just wait on God and be as supportive as you can be. God calls shepherds to a church, and God knows when to call them away or call them home. Depend on it. Otherwise, you will get caught up in something evil that will wreck the church you propose to save. You will mess up your conscience, and you will bring down upon yourself the disciplinary hand of God. Stay out of it. I remember shortly after I graduated from seminary, back in another lifetime, I had a friend and acquaintance, wasn't a real close friend, but an acquaintance. We shared a mutual background in athletics, that kind of thing. He took a position in a church not far from the seminary, He was the young man on the block, and he was very exciting to the people. Pastor was older. Pastor had been there for a generation. This fella that I'm talking about just kind of figured on his own that it was time for the pastor to move on, and hey, the people seemed to love him, and so in some manner or other, I'm not just exactly sure, he exploited his hotshot status right out of seminary, and the people had built him up as the next great thing, and it all went to his head. He just knew that he was the future of that body, so with the help of some of his supporters, this man that I'm talking about made a move to ease the veteran pastor out, a faithful pastor who had been there, I think, as I said, for over 30 years at least, almost a generation. Well, that coup failed. He thought he had more support than he did. That's typical. Some people, always wanting to support a young pastor, confuse him with making him think that he is the next great thing. And after that failed coup, that young man, right out of seminary, but same vintage as myself, he got a bad rep, but it was deserved, however. And you know what? He never really caught air again. I think that was God's discipline. Reject the ways of Absalom. You'll be miles ahead. Don't you think God knows how to move the pawns on his chessboard when he, God, is ready? Besides, I'll tell you something. Young men are exactly what a church or an organization don't need, at least a lot of time. There are some young men who are very, very wise and very godly and exceptionally mature for their age. That's the exception. Wisdom is more regularly with gray hair than shabby jeans and distressed hair with a lot of product. Never forget that. I know this. I'm a much wiser pastor than my church would have gotten when I was age 25 or 30. Yet I'll bet you a dollar to a donut that any given church in this youth-loving culture would be more likely to call a more youthful version of me than this one. And that, I know, would be a great mistake. You see, we're just too wise for our own culture. We think we know more than we do. Now, let's see how this tragic episode in the life reign of David unfolds. It came about that after this, 2 Samuel 15, that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners to go before him, all, you know, giving off the air of royalty on the move. Absalom used to rise up early and stand beside the way to the gate, the city gate. And it happened that when any man had a lawsuit, to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would intercept him. He'd call to him and say, "From what city are you?" He would say, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." You know, the 10 northern tribes, the jealous tribes, jealous relative to Judah. And Absalom would say to him, "Oh, you know what? Your claims are good and they're right. It's a shame nobody listens to you on the part of the king." And there he is with his demagoguery, ingratiating himself with the people. Absalom would say things like this, "Oh, that one would appoint me a judge in the land." Then this nonsense would end. Every man who has any suit or cause, I'd give them access to me and I would give them justice. And it happened that when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, Absalom again, notice this ingratiating way, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him in a very friendly way. And in this matter, Absalom dealt with all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. And here's the bottom line, verse 6, "So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel." Judging from Absalom's stratagem, which I think we can infer targeted an observed weakness at this point in David's oversight and administration, for some reason or other, there was probably some lag or perhaps laxity in the administration of justice in the kingdom. That's what Absalom seems to seize upon. That was the chief function of the king. Of course, no more than Moses in his day, the king could not adjudicate personally all matters of justice. Throughout the kingdom, there were lesser officials to handle the more routine cases. But if there was any analogy between the ways the wheels of justice move in that day and in our day, they move somewhat slowly. A lawyer on my staff, our business manager, says that the wheels of justice move like clunk, clunk, clunk. No doubt the sluggishness of the system, capital S, at times frustrated many of David's constituents. There would no doubt be a constituency of the disaffected out there for Absalom to tap into. He was sly, he was cunning, and he knew just exactly how to play upon people's frustrations, play the demagogue to David's disadvantage. Most of the court proceedings in those days took place at the city gates. There one would find public officials posted to do business. What Absalom did, now that he had established himself as a royal, was post himself along the road leading into Jerusalem, where, as I say, he could intercept complainants on their way to have their cases heard by either the king or his royal representatives. And apparently he was assiduous about it. Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gates. And here's the way he'd play the game. Somebody had some kind of lawsuit. Absalom would call him aside while he was en route. He'd warm up to him. I mean, when this heir to the throne showed this affected deep personal interest in their legal troubles, they were overwhelmed. Find a person with a victim mentality. You tell them you are their champion. You tell them that they are getting a raw deal, and you'd just love to help them if only you could find your way into high places, and you have their vote. We see it all the time, the demagoguery of politicians. That was the cunning Absalom. Our Congress and state legislatures and city offices are filled with politicians who play the same game right into their precious offices. Absalom really ought to be their patron saint. I'll paraphrase Absalom's subversive lines. I'll tell you something, brother, your complaints and claims are just. This should be a slam dunk if only you could just get in front of a just judge. But unfortunately, the lines are so long and the judges are so few, implying administrative dysfunction, that you may never get your day in court, or worse, not get the justice you deserve if you happen to get your day in court. You know, my friend, though I'm a royal, I feel helpless. It shouldn't be that way, should it? Oh, I just wish that I had the authority to adjudicate your cases. If I did, you'd get swift justice, the justice you deserve. It's just a big shame that nobody is there to listen to you right now. Message? If I were in charge, that would change in a New York minute. And without ever using David's name, Absalom was insinuating that the king was either disconnected or disinterested, or just asleep at the switch while the administration of justice was floundering. Again, to use that word, because it's the right word, it was very demagogic, very subversive. But it worked for Absalom, and before you know it, Absalom is gathering a big following, especially among all the tribes other than Judah, who always, though the majority, were infected with what I call a neglected minority mentality. Now they had, they thought, in Absalom, a champion. I'm not the first to suggest this, but there is probably some truth in the allegation that in David's kingdom at this time, the wheels of justice were perhaps not running as smoothly as they ought, for whatever reason. And whatever it was, at least gave to people on the ground below that appearance. Whatever it was, Absalom spotted a weakness and he exploited it. And he made it work for his treasonous intentions. Then, in the phoniest way you can imagine, he would further ingratiate himself by playing the egalitarian. They would try to bow before him as a royal, and he would not allow them. But rather, he'd put out his hand, draw them near in an act of familiarity, as if he really cared, kiss them in the Oriental fashion of dear friends. Well, in this manner, Absalom dealt, we see in verse 6, with all of Israel, who were coming to the king for judgment, not necessarily directly to the king, but they were coming to the king and his apparatus of royal justice. So Absalom was successful. He stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. Gradually, he became their guy, as their loyalty slowly shifted from King David to his cunning and rebellious son, Absalom. Subversive son. There is a lesson here, I think. Folks, it is a lot harder for enemies to take advantage of us when there is no truth to whatever charges they make than when there is at least some element of truth in their criticism, or if not that. We operate in such a fashion as to lend credence to critics, whether true or not. I remember I was warned about it. I like to be open and vulnerable, and I have at times laid myself open in that spirit when I tell people of my enormous temper. Now, what you've got to know is I virtually never lose it. In 21 years, as we speak, I've lost my temper here in my church life one time. I've been irritated, things like that, but just losing my temper, if I lose it, you'll know it. But because I said it publicly, it was easy for an enemy to claim after a very temperate talk with him that I'd gotten out, walked out, slammed his door behind me, and stalked down to my office. No such scene ever occurred in his office. Not in going into it, not in walking out from it, or any of that. But because I had advertised a latent vice, he devilishly took advantage of it and was able to make it stick with some, because, after all, I have been vulnerable and said that I have, which I do, an enormous temper, which I also make the point, I almost never lose, at least in public. My wife's seen me lose it. My kids have seen me lose it. But in public, as an adult, that's a very rare, rare occurrence. Well, Absalom found some flaw in the law system, and he was able to make it stick, though probably not justified to the extent that he made it appear. One famous man once said that as much as he disliked criticism, he preferred that criticism that came from his enemies. Why is that? Well, because even though it may not be essentially true, that criticism coming from his enemies, he found that his foes often identified some element of weakness that he needed to pay attention to, even if they grossly exaggerated it. They may magnify it unfairly, he said, but they often have their finger on at least something that we need to fix, whether it is a vice, or perhaps it's just some way that we carry ourselves, or some way that we state ourselves that gives the appearance of truth to their criticisms. I think of persons, for example, who sometimes are criticized for being haughty or standoffish or better than thou, but sometimes it just turns out that those people are merely insecure. I remember when I was teaching in Bible college back in the Denver area all through the 70s, there was the wife of one of our faculty members who appeared to be just like that, appeared to be haughty, appeared to be standoffish and better than thou. But eventually, it turned out that she was just a very, very insecure individual, just the opposite of what she appeared. A folk can put two and two together and get five, and that's what Absalom did. Enemies love to do that. And you and I just need to be aware of that tactic. And being aware, try not to give them any more line than necessary to try to hang us with. That's so easy to do. There is no fail-safe ground that we can find. We're all flawed. We all have our weaknesses, and we all have those sins to which we are individually prone. We grow in grace, but we never entirely grow out of these things. But we need to understand the dynamics of these matters and just be more careful. If people say that we're insensitive, we need to find out, if we know good and well that we're not insensitive, we need to find out, okay, what is it? I hear that a lot, so what is it that gives people that impression? We need to ask ourselves. And we can never make ourselves completely invulnerable, but we just don't want to give away ground unnecessarily in those kinds of situations. Well, that's what David had apparently done. His administration was not a perfect administration. It wouldn't be in any time. The only perfect administration there's ever going to be is when the kingdom of God appears and the Lord Jesus Christ reigns. We're all human. But his eye was not completely on the ball, and in his administration of justice through the apparatus, David probably exposed himself by being careless, I'm guessing, sometimes in the administration of justice, even though overall it was sound and good. So in our personal lives, we need to be careful about that kind of thing. Well, in verse 7, Absalom is about to make his move to dislodge David from the throne. It all begins when he asks his father David to give him permission and to give Absalom his blessing to pay my vow, which I vowed to the Lord in Hebron. All of this is a setup. It's all a pretext, and we're going to see how it so tragically plays out. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.